Aquinas. Basically, what we were dealing with is first principles of knowledge. Now, again, he believes they're self-evident, but that does not mean that he believes that we have these ideas in us when we're born or at conception, whatever it may be. We don't have any knowledge. We start as a blank slate, but our minds were created in such a way that we are able to recognize and abstract certain rational principles, rational conclusions from sense experience. And so these become evident to the mind during sense experience. And there's the law of identity, being is being. Again, remember we talked about that dogs can think, but they can't think about thinking. That's one of the things about being human. Now, of course, there are other things that separate us even more from the animal kingdom, such as the fact that we can fellowship with God, we can think about eternity, but we can think about thinking. It actually worries me when, you know, not every American is going to be called, not every Christian is going to be called to be a philosopher, but it does worry me that so many Christians think that philosophy is a waste of time. Because that's one of the things that separates us from the animal kingdom. It's a God-given ability. It's an ability that makes us something that we have in common with God that the animals don't have. When we don't think about thinking, it makes it much harder for us to be good thinkers. And if we're not good thinkers, it makes it a lot easier for us to be enslaved. A well-educated populace, I mean, there's almost always going to be a certain amount of book burning that goes on whenever dictators take control. And, of course, the Bible is going to be the first book that they're going to want burned. The law of identity, the principle of identity, this sounds stupid. Being is being. A equals A. I mean, but the fact of the matter is, if you weren't able to recognize this door as this door, you really can't even get started in thinking. So if I say, well, oh, there's Don. Well, I'm recognizing that Don is Don. And so it's as basic as you can get. Now, if I come in here and there's only one person down here, let's just use our imaginations and say I came early on one night, and one person's down here, and I come in, I think, hey, maybe that's Don, and I look, and it's Andrew. Well, then I say, okay, well, that Andrew is non-Don. That's the law of non-contradiction. Being is not non-being. That means that A does not equal, A cannot equal non-A at the same time in the same sense. The statements God exists and God does not exist cannot both be true. If one is true, the other has to be false. The law of excluded middle, something either is or it is not. That's either being or non-being. Causality, non-being cannot cause being. See, non-being is nothing. Nothing can do nothing. Therefore, nothing can cause nothing. So if something came into being, something else had to cause it to come into being. Every effect must have an adequate cause. You cannot posit nothing as that cause. Now, this sounds like, you know, real kindergarten stuff. That's why it's the first principles of knowledge. The fact of the matter is, number four, causality, that's exactly what our evolutionary philosophers and scientists are rejecting today. Some of the world's leading philosophers are now saying that since science has proven that the universe had a beginning, and they don't believe that God exists, therefore the entire universe popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause. And it's like, no, non-being cannot cause being. From nothing, nothing comes. If the universe had a beginning, something else that already existed had to bring it into existence. And then the principle of finality, every being acts for an end. So it might be a little bit harder to see, but if you just, again, he's all caught up in the world of the senses, being Aristotelian in his thought. So Thomas Aquinas would see acorns growing up what do they grow up into, oak trees? Yeah. You know, he would see the same things in nature, that things were created for a reason, for a purpose, and moving towards that purpose, acting towards that end. So he sees these as the basic principles of knowledge. Aquinas, obviously, he also believed in the basic reliability of sense perception, otherwise he would not be an empiricist. As an empiricist, someone who believes that knowledge is attained through the five senses, you have to believe in the basic reliability of sense perception. Now, I'm not an empiricist. I'm more of a rationalist, but I do believe that our sense experiences, our sense perception is basically reliable. It's not so much that our senses deceive us. Sometimes we misinterpret what our senses are telling us. So we say on a hot day we're driving down this hill, we interpret that there's water at the bottom. But I think it's actually that we're misinterpreting our senses, or there could be something faulty with our senses. If you're going blind, that would certainly play a role. But I think as Christians, we have to hold to the basic reliability of sense perception, because if we don't, then why should we base our faith on the apostles who claimed that they saw Jesus risen from the dead, and they may even have touched his wounds, and they heard his voice. So they trusted their senses. God reveals certain things to us through our senses. Gordon Clark was a great Christian philosopher of the 20th century, died in 1985, but he rejected the possibility of finding any truth through the five senses. He was a very unique Christian. Some even kind of questioned salvation late in life because of some of the conclusions that he was drawing from this. But Gordon Clark said that you cannot find any truth through sense perception. So he hated Aquinas' thought. Tears up Aquinas in his work. Sometimes he makes some good statements about Aquinas. I mean, sometimes his corrections of Aquinas hold water, sometimes they don't. At Dallas Theological Seminary, when he was slamming Norman Geisler, who was teaching there, Gordon Clark liked to slam everybody. Nobody agreed with him, so he had to slam everybody else. And so one of the students said, "Now you're saying that we can't find any truth through the senses." And he said, "That's right." And then the student said, "Well, then how do you know?" And he said, "The only truth we can find is in the Word of God, because in the end, Gordon Clark's view is what I would call scripturalism, that truth can only be found in the Word of God." And so Gordon Clark agreed, yes, truth can only be found in the Word of God, can't be found in the world of the senses at all. And so the student said, "Well, then how do you know that's a Bible that you're holding in your hands?" And Gordon Clark's response, this is why late in life some of the other professors were witnessing to him or questioning whether he was even saved. I listened to this on tape. "How do you know that's a Bible in your hand?" His response was, "What Bible?" I do think, even though I'm not an empiricist, I do believe that God has equipped our minds to find truth, to draw truth from sense data, but I do not believe we start as a blank slate. To be a pure empiricist, you have to start life as a blank slate, like Aristotle and Aquinas argued. I disagree with that. So it's kind of, I'm not an ultra-rationalist, but I believe that, and even the reason that we use is not unaided human reason. Even if we're atheists, it's a reason that, you know, God has to keep an orderly universe orderly, sustain it, and sustain our existence. And so everything is dependent upon him, even our knowledge of physical things. I do agree with Aquinas that our sense perception, that we can trust our senses to a certain degree. Now, Aquinas rejected the ontological argument because the ontological argument, it starts in the mind and it concludes in the mind. It never gets to the realm of the senses. It doesn't have to. It tries to prove God's existence in the realm of ideas. Aquinas obviously has to reject that. He has no choice. His philosophical system, if all knowledge starts in the world of the senses, and the ontological argument never gets to the world of the senses, then and even if it gets there but it doesn't start there, it's just not acceptable. It just contradicts Aquinas' thought. See, theologically, I talked about this last week, you know, he's Roman Catholic, I'm not. So theologically, I had a lot of disagreements with Aquinas, though there are some agreements, areas of agreement, doctrine of the Trinity, the deity of Christ, Christ's substitutionary death on the cross. There's a lot of agreement there, the Bible being God's word and without error. But he's got his little Roman Catholic ideas that I disagree with. Okay, so theologically, I have some problems with him. His philosophy, though, I disagree. I take more of an Augustinian epistemology. My theory of knowledge, my starting point, is much closer to Augustine's. Having said that, though, after you get started, there's a lot in Aquinas that I really like. But it would just be dishonest if I called myself a Thomist or a Neo-Thomist. To be a Thomist or a Neo-Thomist, you really have to start with his empiricist epistemology, his theory of knowledge that starts in the world of the senses. So he rejected the ontological argument because he started with sense data. But he also rejected, and I disagree with him on this point, he rejected the Kalam cosmological argument. Remember, Bonaventure and he did not see eye to eye on this. They were contemporaries. They butt heads. I think Bonaventure was right on this issue, that we can philosophically prove the beginning of the universe and argue that therefore the beginning, the universe has a beginning, therefore it needs a cause. God caused the beginning of the universe. Aquinas said no. You know, Aristotle was the greatest philosopher. According to Aquinas, he believed the universe was eternal. Therefore, if you're going to find evidence for the beginning of the universe, it cannot be found in human reason. It cannot be found in philosophy. Can't be found even through our senses. But Aquinas did accept the Bible's account of creation, but he believed the beginning of the universe because the Bible taught it, not because it could be proven through reason. So he rejected the idea that you could prove the beginning of the universe. I agree with Bonaventure that it's an actual impossibility for there to be an infinite number of moments before the present moment now, because it's impossible to traverse or pass through an infinite number of moments. No matter how many moments you pass through, there'd be an infinite number of moments beyond that. So we would never reach the present moment now. Since we've reached the present moment now, there had to be a first moment. So the number of moments in the past is not infinite. It's finite. There has to be a first moment. So the universe had a beginning. So God exists outside of time and eternity. He created the universe. And Aquinas would agree with that, but he would not agree that you could argue philosophically for the beginning of the universe, though he did believe the universe had a beginning, but he got that from the Bible. Now this leads to the two big distinctions in Thomistic thought. You know, one of the biggest dichotomies that he calls upon, and that is that he believes there are certain doctrines of reason and there are certain doctrines of faith. There is some overlap between the two. For instance, some doctrines of faith, some truths that we know, like the existence of God from the Bible, are also doctrines of reason. We could, even if we didn't have a Bible, we could prove that God exists. So a doctrine of reason is something, some truth that we could prove through reason alone. We don't need a miracle from God to know it. Okay, those are doctrines of reason. Doctrines of faith are those truths taught in the Bible that we would never figure out through reason alone. Now let me say this, because so much of his ministry emphasized, and I do not understand why most Protestant thinkers that can't stand Aquinas, if you ask them, well, why don't you like his philosophy, they say, well, he thought he could prove everything through reason alone. No, he didn't. This is one of the biggest distinctions that Aquinas drew. Distinction between doctrines, truths that you could find through reason alone, and then there's truths that you could only find through faith. God doesn't supernaturally reveal it to us, especially in His Word. There's no way, like the doctrine of the Trinity, there's no way we're going to find that through reason alone. Yet, so many Protestant thinkers say that Aquinas believed you could prove everything through reason alone. No, that totally contradicts one of the biggest thrusts of Thomistic thought, of Aquinas' thought. The Protestant thinkers that will give you, they'll say, yeah, you know, I agree, Aquinas did draw this big distinction between doctrines of reason and doctrines of faith, but he acted like, well, we only need God out here. We don't need God for doctrines of reason. We could find out this truth through unaided human reason. We don't need help from God. Let me say this. Aquinas, even though he had a different epistemology, different theory of knowledge, even though he was an empiricist, started with the world of the senses, and Augustine was a rationalist, started with the realm of ideas, Aquinas, especially theologically, but even philosophically to a certain degree, did not view himself as an opponent of Augustine any more than Aristotle viewed himself as an opponent of Plato. In other words, a big emphasis in Augustine's thought is that no matter what God has revealed to us, whether through nature or through the scriptures, it's all revelation. That was a very big emphasis in Augustine's thought, that God has to illuminate our minds to find truth, even in the realm of nature, not just the realm of faith and the realm of the scriptures. So all truth is God's truth, and every truth that we find is because God revealed it to us. So he may have revealed it to us through nature and the minds he's given us, or he may have revealed it to us supernaturally through miracles or through the Bible. Aquinas, on the other hand, he chose to look at natural revelation, God revealing himself to us through nature, and supernatural revelation, God revealing himself supernaturally to us through miracles and through the Bible. Aquinas chose to emphasize the distinction between the two. So keep in mind here, the biggest difference between Aquinas and Augustine, apart from their starting points, apart from their epistemology, the biggest difference is not that one believed all truth is revealed to us from God, and then Aquinas didn't believe that, believed in unaided human reason. No, both would agree that everything that we know is revealed by God. It's just that Aquinas chose to emphasize the distinction between the two. What things are there that God naturally reveals to us so that we find them through reason, but it's not the unaided human reason of René Descartes, who came much later? And what points of knowledge do we find through faith in God's revelation, God's special revelation alone? So keep in mind, the major difference is that of emphasis. He's not disagreeing with Augustine that all truth is God's truth. He's not disagreeing with Augustine that even truths that we find through reason, it's not unaided human reason. See, Aquinas is always slammed for having this arrogance that through unaided human reason we could find all truth. They're reading Descartes into Aquinas. Aquinas was so humble in his thought. You know, people try to figure out his devotional life based on his theology textbooks. You know, don't ever do that. Like, I've read the theological works of Miller J. Erickson, and then I met him in person, and he's a great guy, and he loves the Lord. Don't judge his walk with the Lord, his experience of God, based on his theology textbooks. But with Aquinas, not only do we not know, will we never know everything that God knows, but even the truths that we know about God, every one of those truths we only know in a limited way. God knows each and every one of those truths infinitely. He infinitely exhausts everything that can be known of each of those truths. So there's a humility in Aquinas that is not even found among evangelical thinkers today. So the doctrines of reason that we could find through natural revelation, they could be proven through human reason alone. That means human reason apart. It's not unaided human reason, but it's human reason apart from God's revelation in the Bible. That you could find some truth. You know, you can be a scientist and find truth from science, and if the Bible doesn't speak on that topic, you don't have to say, well, then it's really not a truth. No, if it's true, if God really, truly, and you're properly interpreting it, and God truly revealed something to you as truth through nature, then it's true. But the doctrines of reason could be proven through human reason. These would be things even the pagans could find these truths totally apart from the scriptures. He believed that you could prove God's existence through human reason. Now the Bible talks about it. God's existence falls in both categories. It's a doctrine of reason. You could prove it, find it through reason. But you could also read the Bible and then say, wow, God exists. This book sounds like it's true to me, and it's talking about God and God's chosen people, so I guess God exists. And so he would say God's existence could be proven through reason, that there's only one infinitely perfect God, there's only one God, and that God is the cause of all perfections that exist. Then he would talk about the possibility of God talk, the possibility of talking about God, and natural laws, God's moral laws written in our hearts, he believed you could find apart from the Bible. Now let me say this, I mentioned it last week, but I think Gordon Clark was right on when it came to natural laws. And he said that there's no way you can get moral laws from a mound of dirt. What he's saying is there's no way you can start with empiricism, the world of the senses, and draw out of them moral laws. And I'm in agreement with Gordon Clark on that point. There's just no way you can do it. Now, Aquinas thought you could. But Aquinas thought that through reason and sense experience, somehow we arrive at these moral laws, when the Bible clearly says that God wrote them on our hearts. Doesn't even hint at any sense experience involved in it whatsoever. And you know, he can't even have these, you know, innate ideas in the subconscious realm that are triggered by sense experience, because that's pretty close to me, and I'm a rationalist. Just having the innate ideas of what is right and what is wrong, you leave the realm of empiricism. So these doctrines of reason, let's look at some of them. Now, doctrines of faith, by the way, would be things like the doctrine of the Trinity, the incarnation, that, you know, that God is three persons, that God the Son became a man. Those would be examples of doctrines of faith. So let's take a look at some of these doctrines of reason. Aquinas argued that there's five ways that you could prove God's existence. He gets this almost straight from Aristotle. I really don't think they're arguments for God's existence, to be honest with you, so much as he states this in the Summa Theologica, I answer that the existence of God can be proved in five ways, but it's not really like he's starting with no knowledge and then trying to prove God's existence. He has the world of the senses. He's finding the first principles. And it's more like these are five ways to show that God exists. Now, and it's really weird because it's... And I like using the word argue there, but the way philosophers use the term argument, they act like Aquinas is arguing that we can prove this with absolute necessity, with logical necessity. And when they accuse Aquinas of that, they're reading Descartes into his thought. In fact, Aquinas wouldn't even call it logical necessity. He would call it existential necessity. In other words, his whole thought presupposes a physical realm. He's an empiricist. He's not even going for logical necessity. Aquinas might have to add a few premises to make his arguments hold water in today's philosophical climate, but that's exactly what Neo-Thomists have done, his new students have done. They just added a few premises because there were things in Aquinas' day that everybody accepted that are no longer accepted, that people are skeptical about some of those things. But his five ways to prove God's existence, he argues from motion to the unmoved mover. Now, we don't think of motion in the same way that Aristotle and Aquinas did. Motion is just the, you know, if something is here and then it moves to there, okay? It was being here and then it became here. Its motion is like the, when, especially if you're an empiricist, it's the most obvious kind of change we observe. Okay? And so Aquinas is starting with the, like Aristotle, with the Heraclitus thing. No one steps in the same river twice. Everything is flux, in a state of flux. Everything is changing. Well, Aquinas and Aristotle said, no, everything cannot be changing. If everything is moving, something has to be totally stationary. There has to be the unmoved mover. If everything is in a state of becoming and changing, so the things did not exist and then they became and they existed, eventually you have to arrive at something that is pure act, something that exists totally on its own. So he argues from motion to the unmoved mover. I think that we could explain that a little better, understand a little better if he said that he argued from change to the unchanged changer. Then I think it would make a little bit more sense. He argued from effects to a final cause. You really don't explain the existence of effects by talking about the causes that cause those effects if those causes are also effects. No matter how many effects you have, you will not get the one effect that you were talking about at first. You won't get that effect no matter how many other causes you mention if they're all effects, until eventually you get a cause that is not an effect, an uncaused cause. Okay? Now here's the interesting thing. There's three different kinds of cosmological arguments. I'll talk about Leibniz first. Leibniz was a rationalist. I think there's a place for this, for all three types, but Leibniz argued for God's existence, used the cosmological argument from sufficient reason. He argued there has to be a sufficient and adequate explanation as to why everything that could possibly not exist does exist. And so eventually you have to arrive at a self-explained being. Now Leibniz would not equate a self-explained being with a self-caused being. This is impossible for a being to be self-caused. It would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to bring its own existence about. That's impossible. But a self-explained being is a being that contains in itself its own explanation as to why it exists. So Leibniz would say, well, a self-explained being explains its existence by it being an uncaused cause. Okay? So there's the sufficient reason, an explanation in the mind. We find an explanation as to why everything exists that doesn't have to exist. Every contingent, dependent existence, why it exists. The Kalam cosmological argument argues that the universe had a beginning. Whatever has a beginning needs a cause, therefore the universe needs a cause. Aquinas, though, what he's arguing for is its existential causality. Aquinas is arguing for the cause of the continuing existence of things, okay? It's not like he's asking what brought this bottle into existence. It'd be more like you'd be saying, well, this bottle is hovering 3 feet over the floor. How can that be? Well, because it's on this slab of wood or particle board, whatever it is. Well, how is that hovering 3 feet off the ground? Well, it's connected to this and it forms a table and it's on the floor. Well, how's the floor hovering off the ground? Well, there's a foundation that you know, and so basically, Aquinas isn't going backwards in time. He's just looking for the cause that's holding it together, so that keeps it in existence. So keep that in mind. So when he goes from effects to a first cause, it doesn't mean a first cause in time. It means something that is existing right now, grounding our existence. And we don't even think that way nowadays. We think of we don't even think of simultaneous causation. We think of causation. What caused that ball to go over the fence? Well, I hit the pitch with a bat and it knocked the ball over the fence. Okay? So we think cause and effect, and effect follows the cause in time. We don't think about simultaneous causation, but it happens all the time. When you look in the mirror, you are the cause of that ugly reflection that's staring back at you, okay? And if you remove the cause, the reflection is gone too. That's just going to be real tough for you to prove that. You have to have a friend verify it. But it's the same way. If God doesn't sustain us in existence, we would go out of existence. Okay, the third argument is from contingent beings or dependent beings to a necessary being. Let me read how Aquinas argues for this so you can just get a little taste of the argument in his words, and then I'll try to explain it. He says, the third way is taken from possibility and necessity and runs thus. We find in nature things that are possible to be and not to be, since they are found to be generated and to corrupt, and consequently they are possible to be and not to be. But it is impossible for these always to exist, for that which is possible not to be at some time is not. Therefore, if everything is possible not to be, then at one time there could have been nothing in existence. Now, if this were true, even now there would be nothing in existence, because that which does not exist only begins to exist by something already existing. Therefore, if at one time nothing was in existence, it would have been impossible for anything to have begun to exist, and thus even now nothing would be in existence, which is absurd. Therefore, not all beings are merely possible, but there must exist something the existence of which is necessary. Now, he knows that there may be lots of necessary beings. For instance, the law of non-contradiction exists in all possible worlds. There's no possible world where truth and falsehood are the same. Okay? And so he knows that there's lots of necessary beings, but he says, but every necessary thing either has its necessity caused by another or not. Now, it is impossible to go on to infinity in necessary things which have their necessity caused by another, as has already been already proved in regard to efficient causes. Therefore, we cannot but postulate the existence of some being having of itself its own necessity and not receiving it from another, but rather causing in others their necessity. This all men speak of as God. So what he's saying is there has to be one ultimate necessary being that grounds the existence of all others. In fact, he doesn't even argue that there has to be one. Later on, when you examine what it means to be a necessary being, you find out that there could only be one. That comes later on in his thought. But so what he's saying, though, is this. Now, he goes to, like, he talks about beginning and this and that. If every being that exists has the possibility of non-existence, okay, pretend this is my... This is like if my arm here is an arrow going back that direction eternally and then going in that direction eternally. Okay? And so everything that exists on this plane. Okay? On this line. Aquinas would say if everything that exists has the possibility of non-existence, then given enough time, every possibility will be actualized. Every possible scenario will be actualized so that everything, if everything that exists has the possibility of non-existence, then everything has the possibility of non-existence. Given enough time, that possibility will be actualized and nothing will exist. But that means if you go backwards in time far enough, you would reach a point where nothing exists. But since from nothing, nothing comes, something must be eternal, for something now is. But the only way for possible beings, this still doesn't, by the way, this argumentation does not prove that the universe had to have a beginning, because the possible, just if you just reason from this alone, and you don't get into any of the Kalam cosmological argument principles, it's always possible, in Aquinas' thought, that as long as a totally necessary being exists and grounds the existence of all these possible beings, that he could have grounded the existence of all these possible beings throughout all eternity. Okay? So he's not saying that the universe had a beginning, but what he's saying, to ground the existence right now of all possible beings, necessary beings have to exist, and even if there's numerous necessary beings, like eternal truths, or eternal ideas, eventually you have to arrive at the necessary being that is a necessary being of itself, and its necessity is not dependent. Like necessary truths, their necessity is grounded in God's mind, but God's necessity is not grounded anywhere. So another way of putting that is, dependent beings exist. My continuing existence, I depend on food, I depend on oxygen, I depend on a lot of different things, okay? You take them away, I would cease to exist and all. But if everything that exists is dependent, then you add them all together and you get one big contingent dependent being that is dependent upon something else for its continued existence. Eventually you have to arrive at a necessary being, a totally independent being that does not depend on anything outside of itself for its continued existence. Okay? So that's the way Aquinas is arguing there. But Aquinas' fourth way is from the degrees of perfection to a most perfect being. We make judgments and say, well, that's good, and that's better, and that's the best, and that's bad, that's worse. And we're drawing different degrees of perfection. Well, then there has to be a most perfect being. We're measuring things by a perfect standard. In other words, you can't say something is evil and something else is even worse unless you have this knowledge of the absolute good. And now, the way I'm arguing it there sounds more like Anselm. When you get a chance, read. Yeah, he says the fourth way is taken from the gradation to be found in all things. Among beings there are some more and some less good, true, noble, and the like. But more and less are predicated of different things according as they resemble in their different ways something which is the maximum. As a thing is said to be hotter according as it is more nearly resembles that which is the hottest. So once we recognize different degrees in goodness and truth and things of that nature, then there has to be that absolute good, that absolute truth. And Aquinas would argue the absolute good is God. His fifth way is from the guidance of the mindless things of nature to the intelligent designer. It's actually a teleological argument, an argument from design, long before William Paley's watchmaker argument, which we'll talk on in future lectures. But he basically says we see the mindless things of nature, like acorns always growing up into oak trees, not apple trees. Even if you assumed evolution to be true, which I would not, this argument still works. This argument for God's existence. Because it says if everything's evolving and changing and moving to the same direction, then there has to be a rational mind guiding it. Arrows don't hit the bullseye on their own by accident. It takes an archer to direct it. When the mindless things of nature progress towards the same ends time and time again, this shows that there has to be a mind, an intelligent designer governing nature and guiding nature.